America behind the wheel, under the hood, and beyond with Car Stuff from HowStuffWorks.com.
Welcome to the podcast. I'm Scott Benjamin.
And my name is Ben Bolin. I am stone cold sober.
Stone cold.
As we do this.
Every time, right?
Do this podcast. No, I'm kidding.
Cough medicine, that type of thing.
You know, I got a rough life, man.
Yeah.
No, actually, I, drinking jokes aside, that's a bit of a segue because we're going to talk about one of the most interesting periods, I think, in American history, in recent American history.
I agree. The era in like the early 1900s, right?
Mm-hmm.
1920s, 1930s, yep. 1940s, that era. There was some pretty cool stuff going on in the back roads in the Southeast here.
Yes.
And, that's what we're going to be getting at here when we talk about, whiskey runners, really.
Yep.
Rum runners, bootleggers, what do you want to call them?
Alcohol smugglers, that's not near as cool as
No, I like bootleggers.
Yeah, I like bootleggers. I like, rum runners and, moonshiners.
You know where bootlegger came from? Did you read this?
Bootlegger, anecdotally, by the way, this is not proven, but people believe that the phrase bootlegger came about because during the pioneering days when it was illegal to sell liquor to Native Americans, there would be people who did so anyway by secreting a flask in their boot, right?
Mm-hmm.
And then, of course, they would, I don't know, make a bajillion dollars and live happily ever after. Hmm. Probably not at that period in history.
See, this differs from what I've heard.
What did you hear?
I heard it was a Civil War era thing.
Oh.
Where they would sneak alcohol into the military camps by the same method.
Okay.
You know, put it in their boot because, you know, they had these tall leather boots that they wore all the time.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, it was just a way of smuggling alcohol into some area that wasn't supposed to be there.
Muy interesante.
Yeah, so, I mean, and there's probably 10 other stories about how that came about.
And they all go back to some situation where some poor sap has to put a flask in
exactly.
his shoe.
Yeah, that's right. So here's where we're at. We got this note from a guy named Big Papa. And you may remember we read this email in one of our Nuts and Bolts episodes.
We sure did, yeah.
And, he had an interest in, he said he has a growing obsession with pre-World War II cars and the people who drove them, more specifically, bootleggers of Georgia and South Carolina, guys like Junior Johnson, Raymond Parks, and Tom Voigt. So that's my suggestion. I'm currently reading a book called Driving with the Devil, that's all about Raymond Parks and his influence on NASCAR.
Mm-hmm.
And, I put it aside for a little while.
Sure.
And then, you know, when we go through our master list of what we want to do and what we want to cover, I had this note and I thought, well, it sounds like an interesting topic. Let me take a look at it. Ben, I'm completely hooked on this now. One thing I got to say up front, and this is just so that, you know, we know, I think everybody already knows this. I'm not the biggest NASCAR fan. I think NASCAR is all right.
Yeah. But, you're not a NASCAR hater. You're not an enemy of NASCAR.
No, exactly. So, you know, stop the hate email right now, but, but I'm more of an open wheel racing fan.
Sure.
And this is not what this is all about. This is about NASCAR and this is about the birth of NASCAR, really.
Mm-hmm.
But NASCAR doesn't hold an interest for me. The story that leads up to it does.
I mean,
because I took a quick look at an excerpt. You know, this is the book that I mentioned, Driving with the Devil.
Yes.
Is by Neil Thompson. And I read a couple of, you know, short articles by Neil and, you know, it describes what it's about and, you know, what his intent was with the book. And, you know, because he said that, you know, you'll often hear this and we're guilty of this too in that, and not that it's so much guilty, but when you mention NASCAR, you say that it arose from the back roads of Georgia, you know, with the bootleggers in their past and history. And that's about it. That's about all you hear about it. It's kind of glazed over in that, you know, you don't get the real in-depth story about why all that happened, how it all came about, and who was involved.
Mm-hmm.
Well, I read an excerpt from his book that was in one of his articles, and it's, you know, from chapter one, and it printed out to be about 7 or 8 pages. I can't wait to get my hands on a copy of this book now, Ben. I mean, I did this, you know, yesterday or something, you know, prepping for this podcast.
Sure.
Didn't have time to grab the book.
Uh-huh.
I want more than anything to read this book now just because of what I read in this little excerpt, which is I mean, that says a lot. Because
do you have a passage you want to read out?
I don't want to read a passage because, you know, I'll let people find it on their own. But I mean,
no spoilers.
It's an excerpt from Neil Thompson's book, and I would say, you know, just take a look at that excerpt and see what you think if you're in the same camp as I am, because it just seems to draw you in, you know, with the intrigue of how this all came about, and really some of the bigger things that were going on in the country at the time that led to the birth of NASCAR. It was like it all happened at once, a perfect storm.
That's exactly what I was going to say.
Yeah.
And also, we want to refer people to, you know, being that we are an automotive and vehicular show, we're not going to do a whole bunch about a lot of historical background. But we will recommend, and I think you guys will enjoy the episode. If you haven't heard it yet, our podcast buddies, Chuck and Josh have an episode on Prohibition. So they'll answer a lot of the non-car questions.
So that gets you to right where we want you at this point, because what we're talking about is, the period between 1920 and 1933 in the United States, which was Prohibition. And, Prohibition came about, was it the 18th Amendment to the Constitution? I think it was in 1919 or something like that. Yeah. And, it was actually later, I mean, I'm going to just tell you now, it was repealed in 1933, and that's why, you know, Prohibition ended.
Right.
Which I believe, and check me if I'm wrong here, but I think that's the only complete amendment to have been, or only amendment to have been completely repealed. Other amendments that have been repealed, only segments of those amendments have been taken away. The 18th Amendment was completely repealed by the 21st Amendment in 1933.
And then there was a little thing in the interim of that you may have heard of, the Great Depression.
Yes.
And a lot of people believe that Prohibition itself was ended due to the taxation benefit or taxation incentive the government could potentially reap if they legalized alcohol again.
Yeah, see, this is the thing. If you don't know what's going on with Prohibition, just a quick note here. It essentially made it illegal for anybody to sell, manufacture, or transport alcoholic beverages in the United States. Okay, so from 1919, but really 1920 is about when they started this.
Yeah,
it's illegal to do any of those things. Now, what usually happens when they make something illegal?
Well, it starts out with the teenagers doing it.
Yeah, that's right.
But pretty soon it ends up being everybody.
Well, it's the idea is that, you know, once it's illegal, then it becomes a commodity that you can then get a lot of money for, let's say. I don't know if that's the best way to...
The criminal underworld then has an incentive to follow up on that profit margin.
Sure, they're going to run a black market is what's going to happen.
And gouge prices, you know, that you would never see in a legitimate market.
Exactly. So there's all this nefarious activity that's happening around.
Oh, nefarious. I love that one. I love diabolical.
Thank you very much. I also like diabolical because Bruce Wayne used to say
we
diabolical.
We totally grew up on comic books.
Yeah, exactly. Bruce Wayne.
Yeah, so there
okay,
we
so,
are.
So the reason that it was repealed is because, you know, this led to this dramatic growth in violent and organized crime in the United States.
Yes.
And this is where you get gangsters like Al Capone. You know, he made a fortune selling illegal alcohol to speakeasies, blind pigs, you know, things
running
like that.
Running it in from Canada.
Exactly. And speakeasies, if you don't know, I mean, boy, I feel like I'm going in this big circle here.
Yeah, speakeasies are just were secret private clubs where you could talk without worry about alcohol. They would also serve alcohol. However, the quality of the booze could be very, very, varied. Very varied.
Look, I want to talk about that in just a moment, but from what I read, speakeasies were more of like a high class situation where, you know, men might be required to wear a suit.
Right.
Women would have to be dressed as well, you know.
Oh, and blind pigs were the other ones, right?
Yeah, yeah. See, okay, the speakeasy was like the high class club.
Okay.
The blind pig was more of a like a corner bar.
That's where you get that carburetor moonshine.
Yeah, that's right. The white lightning that we're talking about. Yeah. The corn mash stuff.
Yeah.
Now, the thing is about so it was like a lower quality, and they might have just beer or real low end liquor. The funny thing about this was the way they got around a lot of these. Now, the name Blind Pig, you know where that came from, right? Did you hear this at all?
I I'm assuming that it's a reference to the blindness that can occur from drinking that. No,
nope. This came from one of these odd little things that it's a way around the law. It was because remember they couldn't sell, manufacture, or transport it, right? So they have this alcohol in the back room, right?
Yeah,
and they would draw the customers in, saying like, it's 75 cents to see the blind pig or whatever.
Yeah.
And since you're paying the admission, here's a complimentary beverage. And so that's the way they get around the law. So that along with your admission to see the blind pig, you get this free bottle of beer.
Gosh, see? So you just keep buying tickets?
Yeah, that's the thing. Like
go see that pig again.
Exactly. Yeah, that was so that's where the term came about. Supposedly.
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 There's some anecdotes.
I'm sure that someone's going to dispute that, but
dude, let's go to. I'm sorry.
Oh no, one quick thing though. You mentioned quality, and you want to wait on this or no? The quality of booze, because...
No, we're already here. Let's do it, because it's a huge thing. Yeah, absolutely.
Okay. All right, quality. Now, this is where, when there's very limited supply, you got people that are willing to risk everything, right? To bring the people what they want. When you tell someone they can't have something, that's what they want, right?
Mm-hmm.
My wife does this all the time.
Oh, God.
Like, you can't have coffee today. You get I know you didn't expect it to go into this, did you?
Well, it's okay because she doesn't listen to the show.
Of course not. Yeah, it's about cars. So, let's say that you're going in for a medical procedure or something and they tell you can't eat after midnight.
Then you don't get hungry till 11:58.
That's exactly right. Yeah. And then she'll say, how am I going to do it? You're like, well, what are you crazy? You don't have to eat after midnight. You never do anyways.
Yeah.
So it just drives her nuts when she can't have something that, they tell her that she can't have something.
Mm-hmm. And that's sort of a common thing.
It's the same thing with alcohol. I mean, I'm sure that people just went nuts when they said, you can't have this. And they said, well, I like that. I need it right now. Yeah. There's a lot of
rabble rousing.
Yeah, exactly.
Rabble, rabble, rabble.
Yeah, exactly. So. There were people that were willing to risk everything, and they would bring alcohol, booze, whatever, liquor, whatever, champagne from Canada, from Mexico, from the Bahamas.
From the Caribbean.
Yeah, the Caribbean. They'd bring it up, and they would say they'd bring it just to the edge of where it was legal, right? And it would be the responsibility of someone to come and pick it up from them.
Yes.
And the thing is with this alcohol that's coming from elsewhere, it would often be relabeled. Mm-hmm. So, you'd have these just really, really cheap liqueurs and beers and things that were relabeled to be premium brands.
Mm-hmm.
And people were paying high amounts for that already. And then, of course, that's resold even higher because of prohibition. And you can see where, the cost of these things was just skyrocketing. So people are making money off of this.
Hand over fist
everywhere.
Money.
That's right. One of the guys, do you have a note about this guy? William McCoy?
Go. No, you go.
Okay. William McCoy, and there's some speculation about this, too. This is all speculation on some of these, not all of them.
Mm-hmm.
This may be where the real McCoy phrase comes in, because he was one that would bring booze from the Bahamas and bring it right up to the edge of, federal waters where, the law couldn't touch him. And then boats, smaller boats would come out, load up, and then head back to shore with their illegal booze. These are the rum runners, right?
Yeah, they were usually called rum runners.
Yeah, the rum runners in the boats. And it was said that, he would be one that would not relabel anything, and he would bring only high quality liquor to the States.
Good business sense.
And they called it, that's where the term came from, the real McCoy. It's not some made up, that's not a fake, that's the real McCoy.
That's a cool.
So it makes sense. But is it true or not?
See, that's another thing you'll run into a lot here. When you're talking about what is essentially a criminal enterprise, there's not really a revealed history, by which I mean there's not a history that's being written down at the same time as the acts are occurring. We have books that look back on it.
Yeah.
With a certain degree of accuracy, but there's always going to be a certain margin of error because we don't. Part of the reason these guys were successful is because they didn't publicize or talk about it.
No.
But fortunately, we know a little bit of cool stuff about their cars.
They're talking now.
Yeah, they're talking now.
Yeah, that's right,
buddy.
I mean, you got
they?
Junior Johnson, who's still out there. Who's what he calls himself now a gentleman farmer.
Yes.
At this point, which I think is kind of cool. I'd like to be a gentleman farmer myself.
I mean, I appreciate him for not going the whole nine and calling himself a squire, a country squire or something.
Yeah, no, he's an interesting cat, that guy.
He is, yeah.
Junior Johnson. He's, hey, one quick thing about Junior Johnson, and I may have to dig in my notes here, so give me okay. just a second, but, go ahead. No, go ahead. I want you
to. Well, I was going to say I can tell you a short story about, moonshine in Tennessee.
Okay, great.
Moonshining, as you know, in Appalachia, is not as common as it was now. In actuality, a lot of the folks who would have been making moonshine, if it was still illegal, are making methamphetamine.
Oh, boy.
Well, it's a profit margin thing.
Yeah.
You know? And it's weird because you can still run across a moonshine still up in the hollers or something. And when I was a kid, we ran into one. We totally thought it was, I thought it was part of a like burned down kitchen. And the only thing that was around was the different, the tubing you see to help with the fermentation.
Oh, sure. The copper tubing.
Yeah. And then an empty refrigerator. I don't know why, man, but sometimes it's like the woods in Tennessee are where appliances go to die.
That and the 700-pound pile of potatoes next to it that didn't give it away?
Or corn,
or whatever it would be, I guess. Yeah.
Well, you know what? It sounds obvious now, but the guy had a really good story about it.
Yeah. You know, I had a friend in high school that made his own moonshine for a short time.
No way.
Yeah, he did. His grandmother taught him how.
Mm,
believe it or not.
Wow.
Isn't that crazy?
I believe it.
And that wasn't here either. Anyways, I got the note about Junior Johnson today. Says he lives life as a gentleman farmer on an estate in the Appalachian foothills. In 1985, President Ronald Reagan granted Johnson a full and unconditional pardon for his moonshining conviction in 1956.
Wild.
So isn't that crazy? So anyways, okay, so let's get back into our moonshining history bit here. Our whiskey runners.
Whiskey runners,
because,
yes.
Because so now you get an idea that, you know, Prohibition was something that made whiskey something very desirable to the American public. And, of course, one of those you can't have it, so you got to you feel like you need it.
And we can assume that made it very desirable as well to law enforcement.
Exactly. Yeah, exactly. They were, going to do anything they could to fight this because they knew that there was this marginal side of society out there that was still enjoying, partaking. And I'm sure plenty of the police officers were at the time, too.
One of my favorite quotations about the Prohibition era is that people will continue to vote for Prohibition so long as they can stagger to the polls. I can't remember who said it, but you've heard that.
Very good. Yeah, I have heard that. Yeah, it's a good one.
So this is big business.
Yeah, it is. And the reason is because – all right, so you got all these places that are wanting to make money, both producing, selling the merchandise, which is this corn mash or whatever it is,
right.
The white lightning, we'll call it that, moonshine.
Yeah.
How do you get it from the stills to where it's to be sold?
And without getting caught?
Exactly. Mm-hmm. Now you got police watching for this type of thing, remember? They're watching for the transport because they know that in the foothills here in the mountains in Carolina, Georgia, those areas, they're producing this stuff. And I'm sure elsewhere, but this is where it's known for and where it came from, I guess.
I give you one thing.
What's that?
You drive in the dark.
That's one thing. Yep. You drive in the dark. Another thing is you modify your car so that it can carry extra weight because you're talking about hundreds of gallons of liquid, and that weighs a lot. I mean, I don't remember what a gallon of moonshine weighs. Not that I would have really known that. I should have looked it up, I guess, but, let's just say it's 8 pounds.
Sure.
What if it's you're carrying an extra 800 pounds in your trunk? You don't think that a police officer is going to notice if the trunk of your vehicle's scraping the ground as you drive by?
Your back end's dragging. Yeah.
Yeah. So, they had, special suspensions that would look the same whether it was weighted or not.
Mm-hmm.
Of course, they were ridiculously fast vehicles.
Yeah.
Because, they've got these giant V8s. The Ford V8s at the time were the ones
flatheads, right?
Yeah, those are the ones that people would just modify the heck out of these things. Mm-hmm. I mean, to the very tip-top of performance where they couldn't go any faster.
Mm-hmm.
That was probably the most popular engine.
Well, one of their mods – I read that one of the modifications they did when they were driving those Fords is that if they could find it, they would take a big Cadillac engine and they would switch it out to get more punch.
Very nice. A big, like a big 500 cubic inch Cadillac engine.
Yeah, yeah,
because those were huge.
Yes.
Yeah.
And that sort of depends on, like, can we fit it in, you know?
Well, see, that's where all this, this kind of like, shade tree mechanic type, engineering comes into play.
I like that.
You know, it's
phrase,
like, it's like, what would, you know, what can I do to this car to make it better than the police vehicles that are going to be chasing me?
Mm-hmm.
And they needed somebody, you know, in addition to all this, they had things like, you know, things that would cover up the license plates so you couldn't see it, or,
right,
you know, something like that, or just no license plate at all.
Mm-hmm.
They would paint the cars in flat black, take off all the chrome so that it wasn't reflective.
Drive with their headlights off.
Drive with the headlights off. Another thing I noticed, or read about was, a toggle switch that they could install that would kind of mess with the light functions in the rear end of the car.
Okay.
So that if they're being chased on a back road by the police, you know, for running this moonshine, they've spotted them already.
Yeah.
They're running, essentially running for their life at this point, is what they said.
Yes. Yes.
They're running from the police. They did this often. I mean, they wouldn't just pull over and say, like, well, you got me. They're taking off, right? And
right.
So it's then a game of driving skill. And you're driving on a dirt road or a, you know, mm-hmm, uphill, downhill, whatever it happens to be in the,
right,
in the hollers.
You're very often taking a curving back road. You're,
yeah,
not on a straightaway, well-paved state road.
No. It's nothing like the police chases we see now, you know, from helicopters where they're on,
right,
the highway and it's, you,
yeah,
know, it's nothing like that, but the speeds are about the same or,
yeah,
faster. And, you know, they had toggle switches where they could, say for instance, they could disable the brake lights. So that the police officer behind them couldn't tell if they were braking and then would go too fast into a turn and, then they would slide off and then you'd be free. Or, you know, maybe it completely disables the lights so that, you know, it turns into darkness, but you can still see with your headlights and you can escape that way. They can't follow you then at,
mm-hmm,
that point. There's just a number of tricks that they employed to get, you know, to get away. The guys that drove these cars.
Yes.
Now, that's the interesting part about this. And, you know, this is where we get back into, Big Papa's note here about, you know, the Jimmy Johnsons and,
mm-hmm,
Junior Johnson.
Junior Johnson.
I probably, if I said Jimmy in another part of this podcast, I apologize, but I meant Junior. Junior Johnson, Raymond Parks, Tom Vogt, that, you know, these guys, there's a number of other people that have real colorful nicknames.
Yeah.
They had a choice when they were young. You know, they had this skill. They could, you know, they knew they could drive.
And they knew the terrain and the area.
They knew the area real well. I mean, mm-hmm, they knew it like the back of their hand because they'd grown up there.
Sure.
The choice for them was either work on the family farm, you know, chicken farm, whatever it happened to be. I don't think at the time chicken farming was big, but it was later. Or they could work at the factory. You know, they could go into town and get a, you know, job at the grocery store or whatever.
Sure.
Or they could make a ton of money running moonshine for the local, local homemade, mm-hmm, distillery.
A ton of fast money.
A lot of fast money. And we're talking big money for at the time. I mean, it was,
yeah,
it was big, big money. And, you know, and it's doing something that you like to do. I mean, it was exhilarating. It was fun.
Uh-huh.
And from that, they became even more skilled because, you know, they're honing their skills on these,
mm-hmm,
what essentially is like a dirt racetrack. It's not,
yeah,
it's not really a racetrack, but they're treating it as such.
And you have a huge incentive to win the race.
Yeah, the incentive is that you don't get locked away in prison or killed.
And there are not the same sort of rules of engagement that we see today in NASCAR. I think that especially, Junior Johnson, some of the other drivers, I don't think they've been given enough credit a lot of times for not just the modifications physically that they made to their vehicles, but their technique, their driving technique here, I think is key. I want to just take this on a sidebar real quick,
sure,
if it's cool. There's this move called a bootlegger's turn. You know what I'm talking about?
No, I don't.
Okay, well, we would call it like a handbrake turn.
Oh, okay.
You know, where you're driving and you need to switch direction completely. And so you pop the emergency brake.
Sure.
And then if you do it correctly, if you are a precision driver, a stunt driver, or bootlegger, then you can do this turn, although, you know, it plays havoc on your suspension and your tires and, hey.
Oh, sure. Flat spots on the tires.
Not great for your, emergency brake either, as
no.
it turns out.
Hmm.
But this move came about apparently, again, anecdotally, through bootleggers, either, you know, they did start playing around with each other,
mm-hmm,
competitively, but
who could make the run faster, that type of
right,
thing.
Right, yeah. But according to legend, or I guess historical truthiness, as Stephen Colbert would say, we have we do think that these this bootlegger turn thing came about when someone was being chased.
Yeah, see, now those guys, though, they would use the throttle to do that same move.
Right, because they have manual.
They had they had rear-wheel drive. Great big V8s, you know, these big Ford V8s, and they would just use the throttle to whip the back end around. Now, in these front-wheel drive cars we have, you have to use the e-brake to do the same thing.
Yeah,
It's a difficult move. Don't try it on the street or anything like that, but it's fun. Do it in the snow.
And another thing that they did, stunt drivers.
No, I'm not recommending that.
Yeah, Scott did not just say
no, I didn't, but do it in the snow.
And overinflate your tires. No, I'm kidding. actually, so this, I just don't think that a lot of people got the credit they deserve, these drivers.
Yeah, they were
for their technique.
Tremendously skilled.
I mean, they're alive.
Yeah.
That itself speaks volumes.
And you know, here's where it happened is that skill from this, I'll call it a profession. This profession. This, you know, from this whiskey running. This
high speed pursuit.
Exactly. The thing that happened here mm-hmm. is that later, okay, they go to, let's say that, you know, this happened in the 20s and early part of the 30s, right?
Right.
Okay. So they've got all these tremendous skills. Prohibition goes away in 33, right? There's mm-hmm. no longer really a need for any of this. Okay, so they still got all this skill.
Mm-hmm.
The guys go off to World War II, fight in the war. They come back, and you know, this is 1945, something like that. They're back in whatever hometown they are in the South.
Mm-hmm.
Not a whole lot going on still in the farming community.
Right.
Although, from what I hear, chicken farming, like I said, was big at the time. Let's say that a farmer had an empty field and he decided, hey, I'm going to make a few bucks by turning it into a racetrack. Because they've got great big expanses of land, and they turn it into a big dirt track. And I'm going to charge admission. I'm going to charge, you know, I'm going to have just run a regular race here, a weekly race.
Sure.
And there's promoters and everything. They needed drivers to come out and kind of thrill the crowds, draw people in. They go back to the bootleggers who are the ones that are like the most skilled or, you know, I'm sure there were plenty of others that tried, but
right.
these guys just outshone everybody.
They're the vets.
Outshowed, whatever. They were the superstars
yes.
of the day, right? Because they had all the skills necessary to drive on dirt tracks at fast speeds.
Yeah.
And to them, this was a piece of cake, right?
Mm-hmm.
So they went race for.
They're like, hey, I'm driving in the daytime.
Yeah, exactly. This is like, and this is back in, you know, the time when a race purse might be $300.
Mm-hmm.
And they said that was only the case if the promoter didn't just leave town with the purse before anybody.
Yeah.
You know, sometimes they'd award a trophy or whatever, and there was no money because, you know, the scoundrel that put the race on for that weekend took off with the cash and
sure.
it was never to be seen again for $300. And this is like the birth, you know, so this racing series began, and this is where the France family came in.
Mm-hmm.
Two guys named Red. I'll have to look at my notes here again. But one was Red Byron, I think was the name of the guy that won the first NASCAR race, officially first NASCAR race. Another guy named Red, I think, was the one who coined the term NASCAR.
Mm-hmm. That's true, yes.
The North American Stock Car
mm-hmm.
Association, whatever, has something like that. I'm not a NASCAR fan, Ben. Anyways, this is where the France family, came in, and they still have a stronghold on NASCAR. And this thing that started in these farmers' fields and literally cow pastures
mm-hmm.
Has now become multi-billion dollar industry.
Yes.
There are 200,000 plus fans at races. There are, sponsorships are in the millions and millions of dollars just to sponsor a car.
Mm-hmm.
This is nothing like what it was back then, only in that, you know, the spirit of it's still there. You know, that the idea that, you know, you can make that car go just a little bit faster with your tinkering. And
yes.
this is the same thing that the whiskey runners would do with their cars. You know, they would modify them right to the peak end that they possibly could and then just hope that they were better than the police cars.
And before anybody writes in to give us a slap on the wrist, if you think that we're glorifying these guys or lionizing them or whatever, we're not really. We think what they did, their vehicles are cool things, and then we think that it definitely shows impressive technique, and we think it's a fascinating story, but we are not condoning smuggling.
No. When you look back, I mean, these guys have arrests and felonies.
Sure.
And yet, like we said,
they're not angels.
No,
they're
definitely
just excellent
not.
Drivers.
But, yeah. That's fine. I mean, that's part of their the checkered past of NASCAR, I guess, is what what they've said many, many times in the news, I know.
As checkered as
and,
the
fight. And that's exactly why what's his name here?
BP, Big Papa?
No. Neil Thompson. That's why Neil Thompson wrote this book, is that, you know, there's a lot more to this.
Mm-hmm.
And I can't wait. I mean, you know, like I said, it was just too soon before we were going to record this that I couldn't get my hand on a book to read it fast enough. But I definitely am going to put this on my reading list for, you know, sometime very soon over the next vacation or something.
What a good – we can go ahead and wrap on this one, right?
Oh, yeah.
Yeah. Yeah, let's go ahead and wrap up on this. And here's a good question, Scott. You gave me a great idea to ask our listeners. Guys, do you have any books about vehicles or interesting stories like the whiskey running bootlegging we talked about today? If so, let us know, because Scott and I are both voracious readers, especially if it's related to stuff that we find interesting, right? You can tell us about that on Facebook, on Twitter, where we are CarStuff HSW. You can also find us on our blog. You can check out our website under the Auto Channel if you have any questions that are not answered. Somehow, they should have all the answers, right? Between all those things.
I would think it would.
Yeah. Well, if we've slipped up a little and we haven't answered something, write to us directly at
carstuff@howstuffworks.com.
For more on this and thousands of other topics, visit howstuffworks.com. To learn more about the podcast, click on the podcast icon in the upper right corner of our homepage. The HowStuffWorks iPhone app has arrived. Download it today on iTunes.